Okay, again, we are continuing our study of chapter 11, and we talked about a couple of things. We've discussed the examples of Abraham, Sarah, some of the other patriarchs, as mentioned in verses 17 through 22, and spent our time in our discussion last week discussing the faith of Moses, and of course his parents and their expression of faith in hiding Moses for 3 months, his faith when he chose the suffering and reproach of the people of God over the material blessings and benefits that he would have received, the prestige as well as the possessions and standing that he would have had if he had remained a prince of Egypt. He forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, verse 27, keeping the Passover with the children of Israel. And then we just, for a few moments' time, talked in verse 29 about the faith of the Israelites themselves as they passed through the Red Sea. And I just wanted to, of course, emphasize the extent of that faith. I remember when I was young watching for the first time the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston as Moses, and the special effects, which at that time no doubt were state of the art, of the sea, of water, the walls of water billowing up on all sides as the Israelites went through the sea. I mean, that was impressive. Now I've gone back and watched it since, and not so much because special effects have. I think if they were to make that movie today, they could even make it more impressive looking as far as the technique. But it was something that really impressed me as a small child, and just imagine what it must have been in real life as you see the pillar of fire before the Israelites that was separating them from the Egyptians. The access down into the water and coming out the other side, and what it must have been like—a very terrifying thing in many respects. But the faith of the Israelites on that occasion, with regard to God's providence and help, is something that certainly serves as a wonderful example to us. But that gets us into the next section of our study, which is basically a very rapid listing of examples of faith. Not a great deal of time is spent, and as I alluded to, simply because of want of time in our own study and a desire to get on to other material, we're not going to. I mean, we could spend a week on each of these names, obviously, and on other occasions will, as we have opportunities to study, for example, the book of Judges, which is a wonderful book if you want to study examples of faith and God's providence. And in fact, the first names that are given, beginning in these this section of our study, all come from the book of Judges, with regard to the list beginning in verse 32. Now, I'm not going to spend much time talking about the faith of harlot. I mean, of Rahab the harlot, as she's referred to in verses 30 and 31. We are told the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days by faith. And by faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. Now, there are two aspects of this one account with regard to the destruction of Jericho, as mentioned in the early parts of the book of Joshua. And you'll remember, first of all, the means by which the walls of Jericho fell. There are an awful lot of explanations that are given. Of course, some reject the account. I've always found it interesting when you go to the modernists how quick they are to reject various accounts. For example, there is, if you go in the Old Testament, with regard to both Old and New Testament, and you look at the archaeology digs in Israel, and all of the evidence that is supplied, which in every case, when uncovered, corroborates the biblical record, then you find individuals when they look, for example, and they begin digging in the city of Jericho, and they claim that there's insufficient evidence. Now, there are some who interpret the digs to indicate that indeed there was a destruction of the city, a complete destruction, but others say, well, it's insufficient evidence. So, because you cannot prove it by the dirt, of necessity, we must deny that it actually happened. And that's kind of typical of archaeologists and modernist theologians. With regard to those things, it cannot be corroborated with that. It seems like at some point in time, when sufficient corroboration is found, with regard to all these other events, all these other places, all these other individuals that are listed in the Bible, and the fact that the evidence always is something that corroborates what the Bible has to say about these areas, that they would at least say, you know, it could be. Just the fact that we haven't found it yet is not sufficient evidence that it, or sufficient cause for us to deny that it happened. But what indeed did happen, as we find, as revealed in that account, is that the people of Israel obeyed some rather interesting, I always want to use the word peculiar in situations like that, which is a valid word. It's just simply that it has kind of a negative connotation. But that's what it was, peculiar commands concerning the taking of the city. And when we say peculiar, it means that not normal, not ordinary, not what you would normally think with regard to a siege of a walled city. They were told to encompass the city and to march around it. And you remember they would march around a single time and then as we progress on the last day, march around it 7 times, blow the trumpets. And the promise was given that the walls would come down, which they did. And But when I indicate peculiar in that it is out of the ordinary, and obviously this is an indication that this would be done with God's power rather than military means, or rather than in some way where men could ascribe to themselves the victory. Despite the fact that it's out of the ordinary, the Israelites did exactly what God told them to do. You know, why are we marching around the city? What good is this accomplishing? And if individuals were not individuals of faith, I can see those types of questions being asked. And in fact, you see time and again these kinds of things as indicative of God's way. God, again and again, with Gideon and his 300, you'll remember, is another example of that, which is actually Gideon's one of the ones in the list, where the force was reduced purposefully so that it could be seen that the victory was because of God's providence and God's direction rather than men ascribing that to themselves. God is the reason why the Israelites entered the land. God is the reason why the Israelites took the land. You remember the previous generation didn't want to go in because they saw the strength of the peoples that inhabited the land at that time. But it was precisely because of the ungodliness of those people that God had determined to judge them and give the land to Israel. And when the next generation entered, they were able to take and to subdue the land because God was with them. And that's, and in fact, God would remain with them if they had done as they were told and completely driven out the people and had not fallen into idolatrous ways. But it all points to this. And this is, I think, the lesson that the Hebrew writer is giving them here, is if you trust in God and you do as God would have you to do, as we've talked about already, as a response of faith, then God will be on your side as well. And God will protect you, and God will give you the victory, as he did in these instances. But you have to have faith, and you have to respond in faith, as did the Israelites on this occasion. It's a wonderful story that we, or an account, a wonderful account that we share, for example, with the children. The children enjoy reading about this, and but it teaches us a grand lesson concerning faith. This was accomplished solely through God's providence. It was a miracle that was performed, which led to the taking of this first city. But it happened because the people did as they were told. They believed God when he gave them instructions, and they did as they were told, even though these instructions were not what you would consider as normal or as would be expected with regard to military conquest. So I think that's a good example. So you have that, and then you have in the same text Rahab, which we've already discussed, which was a wonderful example of an individual who, though she was not herself an Israelite, did believe in God, and as a result of her faith, she assisted God's people, God's chosen nation, and as a result of that, her life was spared. Now, the reason I don't want to spend a great deal of time with Rahab is because we discussed her, as we talked about Abraham back in verse 17, as they were both also referred to by James in his epistle in James chapter 2 as individuals who are justified by works, not by faith only. So we find their faith, their response of faith that they did because they believed, and because they did, they were considered or found to be faithful, and they received the blessings and the promises that God had offered to them. All right, anything about those two examples in verses 30 and 31? All right, then you have a list. You'll notice in verse 32, the list is given of several individuals: Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. But I want you to notice the way in which it's couched again, because what he's basically saying, I've given you all these examples, and I could give you as many more. He said, "What more shall I say?" In other words, how much more do you need in order to be convinced of this point? And he said, "The time would fail me to tell of Gideon." And of course, in Judges chapter 6, we find, I believe 6 and 7, we find the time in which Gideon served as the commander of the armies of God and went up against the Midianites and his victory against them. We have Barak, who following the instructions of Deborah, the judge, went up against the commander Sisera, the army of the Canaanites, and again was victorious. You find Samson, and of course the efforts of Samson with regard to the Philistines, again, are accounts that we tell to our children and emphasize to them with regard to faith and trusting God. How he killed so many Philistines and his fall because of Delilah, and then his ability to restore himself through the final act of valor. You find Jephthah and his battle with the Ammonites, having come from rather pedestrian stock. He is the son of a harlot, and nevertheless petitioned by God's people to lead them, and was victorious over the Ammonites. All of these things, of course, we know of David, know much of him as king and a man after God's own heart, and through his efforts and the consolidation of the kingdom, perhaps the golden age of the nation of Israel spanned him, and then at least a portion of the reign of his son Solomon. Samuel, of course, and the prophets serve as a very important part of the history of Israel. As of course Samuel was the last judge and a faithful man on his own, and as we read about his time spent in the beginning of the kings with King Saul, but the prophets, Samuel and the prophets, what we have here in the period of the judges, in effect, was God ruling directly over the nation of Israel, and Samuel the last of that. But the people, of course, clamored for a king, and so Saul was given to them. But it was not God's intent nor God's desire that the people of Israel be like the nations round about and have a king. You'll remember in his conversation with Samuel, as Samuel was bemoaning the people and their desire to have a king, he said, "They have not rejected you, they have rejected me." And God's intent was always to direct his people and to do so personally. And he did through both the judges, and then later, even during the kingships that we find in both Israel and Judah, through the prophets. The prophets were God's means to instruct his people and to direct his people. The kings, as you look, especially the northern kingdom, in the northern kingdom of Israel, the kings were an idolatrous and ungodly lot. There is not a single individual in the list of kings, beginning with the time of the divided kingdom and the origin of that until the time in which they were taken into Assyrian captivity. There wasn't a single king that was mentioned as being a faithful individual. They were all idolatrous. They all did things that aroused the wrath of God and necessitated God sending A spokesman, that's what a prophet is one who speaks for God, sending someone to give directions to the nation, whether it be combined or the northern or the southern kingdom, to tell them, in effect, to repent and do what I tell you to do. And that's what the prophets did. And you'll remember as Stephen severely admonished the Jews in Acts chapter 7 concerning their rejection of Jesus, and the rejection of his teaching. He said, you're just like your fathers. Just like how they killed the prophets, you have killed Jesus. And that was the lot of the man of God in the history of Israel. Those who brought directions, those who brought a message from God, by and large, were roundly rejected and persecuted as a result of their stand for what is right. And yet, despite the fact that they did not prophesy smooth things, but prophesied what God delivered to them to speak, and they knew as a result of that the consequence of what they were doing, they were bold and did so. And again, wonderful examples of faith. I mean, you take, and I've given this example in the lesson I preached recently on the subject of Elijah and Obadiah. You have Elijah as he presented himself to King Ahab. For a long period of time, he hid himself until such time as God gave him the directions to do so. But when God said, go to Ahab, this was a man who had sought his life. A man who had basically gone to all the nations round about and said, are you hiding him? And you need to promise to me that you're not. I want to find this man. He desired to kill Elijah. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, Elijah presents himself to the king. I'm here, and this is what God has to say. I'm not the troubler of Israel. You're the troubler of Israel, Elijah said. And this kind of boldness was something that was characteristic, not of that man, but of all of the prophets of God. They were wonderful in their courage, wonderful in their unsparing declaration of God's message to those who were ungodly, but also wonderful in the fact that they had a tremendous affinity for and desire for God's people. If you have Hosea as an example, who was an individual that expressed a great love for unfaithful Israel, a desire for her to return, and mirrored that, of course, in his own life. Even Amos, who was perhaps the most him and Elijah as far as the tone of their message, the most unsparing of prophets. Was motivated by a love for Israel. He went up to Israel from the south and saw an ungodly nation full of excess, and it broke his heart. And as such, he diligently proclaimed the message of God to repent, because it was his desire that Israel be restored to a proper standing with God. But these prophets, by and large, were rejected in their message, and often persecuted as a result, not appreciated by what they did, and yet they persisted in their faithfulness. So again, with regard to this list, a fairly lengthy list, we could go and spend a great deal of time with each, and perhaps there is something specific in your study that you do want to mention about any of these. So before we go on, and I do want you to notice what it said concerning these individuals in verses 33 and 34. The list is given, and it said, who through faith they subdued kingdoms, they worked righteousness, they obtained promises, they stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword out of weakness, were made strong, became valiant in battle, and turned to flight the armies of the aliens. These were men of renown. And as you look again, you find their conquest and their exploits to be the stuff of storybook. And yet they really happened, and they happened again, not because of anything simply intrinsic to their person and character, although certainly these were men of renown, these were valiant men, but because of their faith in God. These things were accomplished because they believed and trusted in God and did what God told them to do. And it was as a result of that that these things that were accomplished were accomplished. Okay? So that takes us down 32 down through 34. And again, I don't want to give short shrift to these individuals, though he quickly mentions them, and so we're going to deal with them fairly quickly. But is there anything that anyone wants to add, either about any specific individual or an application that we can make from these things before we go on to the next session? Yes, Dave.
You mentioned about the kings for Israel, and God has certain promises and intents in that. I can see with Jacob and Esau. Jacob was to get the birthright and the firstborn blessing. Well, the way he got it was conniving and conspiring with him and his mother. And then with the kings, according to Genesis 49:10, that Israel was going to have kings. But the kings, what displeased God was the way they went about it. They want a king like those the nations around the bodies, because it was God's intent to have king, because that's what from the tribe of Judah, and that's why our Savior in Christ is king, you know. So it was the way they wanted to apply it. And we want to be like these people, you know. But I can see in the church, but we want to be like and have our fellowship.
Yeah, and that's a question that we could ask, you know, and it would be purely speculative as to in what way would those things be accomplished. What we find is, and this is interesting as you look at the history of Israel, the kingship of Israel, which again, from the tribe of Judah, that it began, again, because of the people's rejection and was marred throughout its history as being evil in every sense of the term. And though there were a couple of kings that could be considered righteous and godly, but it's out of such ungodliness, such willfulness, that again, God's providence led to the Messiah, who is King of Judah and the Lord of our lives. And just another example of how God works his intent even among the rebellious. And we find any number of examples of that both in our history. And of course, we spent some time in the past discussing, I remember in our, I believe it was Wednesday classes, we were discussing some of these individuals in the Old Testament. How often God's plan was completed and accomplished regardless of the sinfulness and the machinations and the efforts of men to thwart it, or the self-willed actions that were done without any concern about God's will and what God desired. It just indicates his sovereignty and the fact that what he determines to do, he will accomplish, and did so with regard to Jesus. Okay, let's continue on. And as you get into verse 35, we find even more generic references to where not even names are named. But I want you to give examples. And again, what the writer is doing is bringing or recalling examples out of the Old Testament. We won't spend the time trying to mark them all down or to figure out which is which. But he mentions that women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. Now, the one thing that I do want to establish from this section of text is how much, beginning in verse 35 and going through verse 38, that section of Scripture is tied up in the idea of persecution and difficulty. How that, what the Hebrew writer is indicating is that faith in Jesus, which is what he says these people had, and we'll see as we draw our time together to a close with regard to that, exactly what was being said. But this faith in Jesus does not lead to an easy life, and it's not something that we should expect either. We live in a day of ease in our nation. We have individuals who are not desiring to come to truth. They will not acknowledge or heed the truth, but instead they heap up to themselves teachers having itching ears. And whenever you have a desire to hear something that will make you feel good. There will always be someone there who will be willing to tell you that. And I made mention of this, I think, in a previous study of a friend of mine that I spoke with concerning his present spiritual standing. And he talked about how he and his wife liked to listen to Joel Osteen. And when I talked about asked him why, he said because of his message and how comforting his messages are. Well, I mean, Joel Osteen is just an example of a man who has 10,000 people that he speaks to every single time he opens his mouth. Well, I say 10,000 people that are present, and millions more that watch him on television. And why is it? Because he's one of those speakers who will scratch the ears of individuals who are not willing to accept truth, but rather want a watered-down version of faith. So what do they want to hear? Well, they want to hear that if you become a Christian, everything in your life is going to get better. You're going to feel better about yourself. You're going to financially receive profit and good as a result of it. People are going to treat you good. You're going to be happier. Everything's going to get better if you begin to serve Jesus Christ. And I just want you to look at what is described concerning these faithful people of old here in this text. These are individuals who were scourged as a result of their faith. They were put to death. Some of them escaped death because of God's providence. But they were valiant in battle, and they were tortured. And instead of renouncing God that they might escape that torture, they instead chose to die, as is mentioned, that they might obtain a better resurrection. They were mocked. They were scourged. They were imprisoned. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. Slain with the sword. And not only that, above that, they were wanderers. They didn't have the things that other people had, the niceties of life, because of their faith. And so, whenever I read things like this, what always comes to my mind is the product of my childhood. But I remember, and I forget who sang the song, the old country song, "I Beg Your Pardon, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden." And I tell you that when we're talking about the what we are promised as the people of God, when we embrace Christ and determine to run that race with endurance, we don't get a rose garden out of it. It's not an easy thing. It's a very difficult thing. But I do want you to be reminded of, and perhaps the one of the best phrases or lines of that has to do with the torturing in verse 35. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Notice they might obtain a better resurrection. Notice that in verse 35. You will also note in verses 39 and 40, these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having presided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. And in regard to that, what that indicates is that this promise of God was not received during their lifetime. That's not saying that their efforts were in vain, but that they lived and died before Christ came. That's the point being made. So here is a wonderful listing that is given. Again, a general listing of individuals who suffer. Why did they suffer? Because of the promises of God. Because they knew, because God had promised such, that if they suffer these things and live in this way, that there is something that is beyond the grave that is going to make it worth their while, worth the effort that they make. Now, the point as we end this chapter, and again, I'll give you opportunity to make comments if you need to, but the point of this chapter is, as he describes these things, he basically is telling them this. These people had such a great faith that they acted in this way, and they denied themselves, and they suffered these things, despite the fact that they lived and died without God having reached that point in his scheme of redemption, where it was the last days, where it was the fullness of time, where the culmination of his plan would be put into place. They lived and died before then, having received with veiled promises, seeing through a veil darkly, not having a full understanding of the very essence of what God was going to accomplish, nevertheless lived and died in faith, looking forward to that. And it was simply that God had promised it. Simply the gleanings that they had with regard to those promises that supported them and fortified them throughout the entirety of their life on earth. And why is he bringing all this up? Well, in the 12th chapter, he said, looking at these examples, if they were able to do it, is it not that we can do it as well? Seeing that we are on the other side of the unfolding of that plan. Now, Christ has come. Now the scheme of redemption is completed. Now we do know the full extent of the promises. Now we have, something that is far better than what they had. So is that not sufficient for us to live a righteous life as Christians? And again, you know, understand he's talking to Hebrews and he's saying, I'm wanting you to look at these individuals that are your heroes and to recognize what these individuals did and what they accomplished, not having what you have. Why in the world now are you lacking in faithfulness? Why in the world are you questioning what you have when they would have given anything to have that? But they died before they received it. Instead, what you ought to do is embrace it fully and to run with endurance the race that is set before you, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of your faith. And so there's an application to that in verses 1 through 2. I don't know why the Hebrew, why the whoever it was that put the chapters in would separate verses 1 and 2 of chapter 12 from the 11th chapter. It just doesn't make any sense to me, because chapters 12 and 1 and 2 of chapter 12 is basically the reason for chapter 11. it's the application that is made concerning the things that are learned. So you have to kind of combine that. Whenever I got my Bible, I always kind of put a line from chapter 11 down to 12 too, because I think those pretty much tie in together. Although the entire 12th chapter basically expresses that same sentiment. Okay, anybody have any comments, questions about those final verses, beginning in verse 35 and going through the end of the chapter? Yes, Dennis. We'll get to you, Charlie, in a moment.
Jesus says in Matthew 5, blessed are those. And in the Beatitudes, and I was always taught that God not showering blessings on you. What I mean by that is you're happy because of these things. And what does he say for the end of those verses is, blessed are those who are persecuted for my sake. He says, so they persecuted the prophets before you. And in those persecutions, he included death, because that's what they did to the prophets. And they well knew this. And the thing that you pointed out that I just wanted to emphasize is through this whole chapter, everything we've seen so far is great examples of faith. No one pays for their faith through their death, except for the exception of possibly David. But from 35 on, he's building his case leading up to Jesus and the fact that he endured the death of the cross. Why was he doing that? We need to remember that these Hebrews, one of very, very plausible and possible reasons, they were abandoning the faith and going back into Judaism with the state persecution.
Right.
Nero, the time is about right for the writing of this book, and the persecution of Nero, that they were escaping death. It was just too much for them to lay down their lives for their faith. And if they went back to Judaism, they could escape that, or so they thought. And Jesus said, that's not the way we should look at it. You know, it's difficult for us to look at it that way today, because we don't face this. Our children or great-grandchildren may very well face it in the years to come. But yet we have not resisted the bloodshed. And as the Hebrew writer sticks to the saying to Hebrews, he says, some of you are going to have to kill him. He said, the point is, you can rejoice. Think of the death that we do face. The death we face sometimes is for blood money. We die from terrible cancers, long drawn out illnesses. How much happier would it be to die a martyr because of your faith, service to God? How wonderful would that be if you have the faith to do that? And that's what he's teaching them right here. And that's what he's going to get into in the next chapter.
Good point. Good point. Charlie, did you answer? Sure. Okay. I've done that many times, so it's. Uh-huh.
Okay, I thought that we were adding our faith, you know, when we got to the church, we were supposed to have it be better than what we were going through without Jesus.
Okay, sure.
The extra with Jesus that you're supposed to have,
Yeah, yeah, it does. But and so and I understand where I may have lost you in regard to that. What Joel Osteen promises in his message is that if you become a Christian, then you're gonna make money because of becoming a Christian. Or if you begin to serve God. If you begin to serve God, then you're going as a result of that, the circumstances of your life are going to immediately improve. What the Bible teaches with regard to the happiness that is mentioned, for example, the Beatitudes that Dennis referred to, is not so much that circumstances will change. I will enlarge upon that in just a moment. But instead, that God is going to give you the ability through His people, through His providence, through His blessings, to handle the circumstances. Because of the change of relationship that you sustained, that now you are the chosen of God and now you are reconciled to God, your focus changes and it allows you and helps you to endure trials and tribulations of life. In other words, the change is more within you than outward circumstances. And that's the problem that exists with regard to many of these religious people today, is because what they're saying is that God intends to change your outward circumstances, as if our happiness and contentment and peace and such are, number one, dependent upon those outward circumstances, number two, tied in with this world. And that's not the case. The reason why I have a better life because I become a child of God is not because of a change of circumstance, but rather because I'm now saved, because I have faith in God, because now I have a hope of heaven, so that no matter what happens to me on this earth, even if it is that I die as a result of the profession of my faith, I've got heaven reserved for me, which is far better. So it's bad. Basically, becoming a Christian is an ability and willingness to exchange the temporal, what's here on this earth, for what comes after. And that's what's being talked about here in this particular text. It's what these individuals did. Abraham was an example. He was in a good situation in the land of his fathers. And God told him, you follow me instead and go. And he spent the rest of his life dwelling in a tent. And he lived and died without having gotten anything that God had promised. It all was promised to his descendants later. So he lived and died in a tent, changed his life entirely, chose a life of a nomad, of a shepherd wandering, just because of what would come after death. And that's what we have to look forward to. Now, having said that, we've touched on this on many occasions. Matthew chapter 6, Jesus talks about anxiety and worry. And in Matthew 6, he says that the Gentiles worry about things. He said, don't worry about things. God clothed the lilies of the field, and God cares for the birds of the air, and he's going to take care of you. Now, those preachers I was telling you about, they look at that and they say, see, what that means is that when you become a Christian, then you're going to get rich, or you're going to be better off financially, and things are going to happen. No, that's not what it's saying at all. What he's saying is, you focus on the spiritual things of life, because if you do that, I'll make sure you have what you need to live. And that's the extent of the promise in Matthew 6:33. If you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, then all these needed things will be added to you. And one of the things that I have applied many times in that is what the Christian receives as a result of their faithfulness. You have a person out there, and we have this happen to us quite often, individuals who are pretty much destitute. And we'll take as an example individuals who come in begging for money, and they come off the street from time to time. And often are really unworthy, because often they are not willing to eat. And often when you give them money, instead of getting something to eat or caring for the family, they're going to get cigarettes and something to drink. I mean, they're in the state that they're in. And I don't want to demean the difficulties, especially in our economy, of individuals who are struggling, because that's not the point at all. I'm just talking about those individuals who are unworthy, but they're in that state. And so what they do, they seek and they beg, and they don't have anyone, and they're having difficulties. What about the child of God? The child of God who is faithful to God. What does that mean? Well, he serves God righteously. He's obedient. As a part of that, heeds God's commands to identify himself with God's people and work with them, worship with them. So now, what happens when something difficult in his life happens, where there's a famine, as was the case in Judea, or there's something that happens to him individually where he loses his things and now he's destitute. What do you do? Well, he's got a lot of Christians who are there, and they'll do everything they can for him because they help and supply, just as the disciples did in the first century and what we're required to do. So there's a difference there. If you serve God acceptably, you're striving to do what you can and living a righteous life, then God's going to supply. Often the way in which he supplies is through his people and the help that is afforded in that way. But you have to make that effort, and that's the promise that is given. And so it's not so much, are things better when I become a Christian? Much in every way. They certainly are. But because of the change that is within me, and now I know that I'll have what I need, so I don't have to be anxious. But I know that no matter what happens to me in life, and if I am persecuted, chastised, if I suffer, that there is something that is reserved in heaven that is better. And that's why it's better. It's not because I offer up a gift to an evangelist as seed faith, that as a result of that, I give $1,000, last $1,000 in my bank account, that God all of a sudden is going to send me $100,000 some other way. It doesn't work that way. And we're not given that promise. And that's what the world is trying to do. Or the plans made. Yes, Ron? A while back. Well, I wanted to address Charlie's concern. Do you want to bring us back to then and make an application?
I wanted to make a note that all of these people suffered these things, mostly at the hands of their own countrymen, who was ostensibly God's people. So when we suffer persecution from our own, let's not be surprised. Because any time we preach it and we give it in its simplicity and in its whole parts, not just some of it, then we will receive the same type of persecution. Time may be coming when we will receive the physical persecution rather than just the mental stuff.
Yeah, it could happen. It certainly can. Okay, well, we're basically out of time. We got through the material. Unfortunately, we didn't get through the questions. I kind of wanted to do that so I wouldn't leave Bob with questions to start off with, but we weren't able to do so. I would ask that you read the questions and answer them, and that's where Bob's going to pick up with the questions on Hebrews chapter 11. Finishing in 11, we've got chapters 12 and 13. Then we'll continue on into the study of James. And depending on how fast y'all go, I may be back before you get through that. Now, when Bob teaches, it may go a lot more quickly. We may have to get into Peter before I get back. But with me, we'd probably be still in chapter 1 when I get back after 3 months. But we appreciate very much your kind attention. Ask that you carefully consider the things that Bob has to say in his preparation, and we'll see you in this class in about a quarter. Okay? Thank y'all for coming.